This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 76th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Dave Evans. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me.
David Evans is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Virginia. His research seeks to create systems that can be trusted even in the presence of malicious attackers and that empower individuals to control how their data are used. Dave is founding director of the interdisciplinary major in computer science, which is a BA, for UVA students in the College of Arts and Sciences, formed in 2006. Dave has a PhD, an SM, and an SB from MIT. He lives in Virginia with his wife, Nora, and baby daughter, Dorina, when he is not on leave in California, which he is now. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Gary. It's great to be here.
So ever since I've known you, you've been committed to interdisciplinary thinking and the notion of spreading the fundamentals of computational thinking as far and wide as possible. So tell us about why you were interested in creating a BA through the college at UVA. Note that CS is part of the e-school.
Right. So when I joined University of Virginia in 1999, which is starting to feel like ancient history, there's been a computer science degree going back to the 70s, but it was in engineering school. And computing as a discipline is really something that pervades all fields. And I started a course that was targeted to non-engineers to learn about computing. And it really wasn't designed with the intent of leading them into computer science majors. At the time, I was really thinking about what should anyone who's going to be a scientist or going to be an artist or going to be a philosopher or an economist or in any role in the world know and understand about computing. And students, at least there were some who took this class and wanted to go on and take more. The way the current the curriculum at the time was structured, there was no real option for that. So I
right,
wanted
so you got
to
them all spun up and then they were stuck.
Right. And so I created a follow-on course that would lead them into the standard courses in the engineering school computer science curriculum that already existed. And once there were students going along that path, well, it made sense for them to also be able to get a major, which was not really possible with the engineering school model. And the way UVA is, which you obviously know well as an alum, and you were a great help in building up this program, the College of Arts and Sciences is the largest undergraduate school. It's about 2 to 3 times the size of the engineering school. It attracts a great mix of students, some of whom are definitely among the best students at the university. So getting those students into computer science and into a program that they could actually major in computer science was really the goal here. But also providing a program that allowed students to pursue other things. And I think a lot of the interest in computing today is really how it intersects with other fields. And
right.
The people that are making the biggest contributions, many of the students have double majors and in lots of fields, cognitive science, economics are the biggest two, but a pretty large fraction of all the students in the BA computer science have enough room in their schedule and enough ambition to do a second major. And that's where I think a lot of the interesting areas are, the big advances in biology and in finance and in business and almost anything you can think of come from applying computing to those fields. And they require people that have deep understanding both of the field they're applying computing to, as well as not just the tools of computing, but really understanding the foundations of it.
What do you think of informatics as kind of the catch-all phrase for that intersection? Do you like that term, or is it incomprehensible?
It's confusing because in Europe, informatics usually means computer science.
Right.
I think it would if the world could agree on terminology, informatics would be a better term for computer science than computer science.
Uh-huh.
We're kind of stuck with what we have, I think.
Right. So, doing anything in academia involves, moving unmovable parts. What were the biggest hurdles in getting this BA idea put through so that you could, build wider computer scientists, so to speak, or more well-rounded?
So it was, I think, ended up being easier than I expected to get the BA at least off the ground. The things that are really hard in academia these days are anything that deals with resources.
Right.
And we were, because most of what was in place to at least start the BA were things that we developed in our own in the computer science department, and we weren't asking for a large commitment of resources to get it started. Once you get past the sort of initial meeting with administrators and make it clear to them you're not asking for anything, mm-hmm. then the discussion of whether this is a worthwhile thing to do, it's pretty easy to make the case that it is for right. an interdisciplinary major in computer science. Uh-huh. Now, long-term, that's a problem, that as we've grown and have more students, in order to sustain a major like this, we do need to find ways to get resources, which turns out to be quite a difficult problem, especially for something that crosses schools.
That, everybody wants the other school to pay for it.
It tends to be pretty territorial, and although you know there was great support from the dean of the college at the time we created the program, there's also turnover, and there's questions about sort of who owns things and who supports them, and it is a challenging thing to have a program where most of the work to support the program comes out of one school, since the CS department's in the engineering school. And that's where the faculty teaching the classes are, and all the resources to support it come from, and the degrees are coming from the college, and that's in some ways where most of the benefits are going. So
right.
it's a challenge in terms of sort of the university politics to have a program that crosses schools.
And it's stymied by its own success.
Something that,
sort
you know,
of
administrators talk about trying to support and enhance these kinds of cross-school programs. Uh-huh. Actually making it work in practice is still very difficult.
How many kids are in the program right now? How's the program faring?
So we're graduating about 40 per year, wow. Probably up to 60 in the next year. So there's it's about the same size as the engineering school CS major now.
That's really, really interesting. So it caught on quick, and it's popular.
It caught on quick, yeah. We had... I guess three students graduated the first year. Those were ones that were already well along the path, and then kind of doubling every year mm-hmm. since then, and getting all of computer science has grown over the last 3 or 4 years, pretty much everywhere. And this program, since it started very small, has grown faster. And there's definitely a tremendous interest among the college students to do computing.
Let's talk about computer security a little bit. So computer security experts today come from lots of diverse areas, as you know. I have yes. a degree in philosophy. Dan Geer was a biostatistician and so on. Are there advantages to this cross-fertilization of fields? And, you know, what do we risk as computer security turns to a more professional certification-based thing?
So I think there's a need for both. There's definitely a need for people with professional training in computer security now, and the real question is, you know, where the big advances are going to come from. And that, I think, does benefit from people coming from other areas, both within computer science and across fields like biology and economics are two that seem to be very important for understanding security today. Mm-hmm. I think it's the case that back in the dark days when I was starting in computer security, that no one got their PhD or had their training in computer security because it didn't really exist as a field
right.
until the late 90s.
Right.
And now it's the case that you know there are students who focus their graduate career and focus their studies in computer security, and that's a great thing for computer security growing as a field. But it does mean that unlike the generation that you and I were part of, where everyone who's working in computer security started somewhere else. Now most of the people starting in working in computer security often spent their whole career there.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess we need to pay attention to that or be cognizant of it. And when we're designing programs, make sure that they provide the width in the program itself.
I think that's important. I think it's... there's definitely value to sort of the short master's program in computer security that's really focused mm-hmm. on just the strength in computer security.
Yeah.
But I think there, you know, for someone who's doing a PhD or becoming a leader in the field, there is a lot of value to bring things from other areas.
Mm-hmm. So you have a talk titled, What Every Biologist, Chemist, and Poet Should Know About Computer Science. And hint, it's mostly about gently introducing core concepts in computability. So what do computer security people need to know about computer science theory?
So they probably at least need to know as much as the poets know. That would be a good starting point.
I didn't expect that answer, but I like it.
Whether the poets really need to know about computability, I'd like to think it improves their appreciation of poetry to understand some of these deep ideas that we think are sort of so core to understanding computing, even if they don't necessarily have that much practical impact on what you're doing day to day. I would want, definitely someone working in computer security should have some understanding of complexity and computability.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily need to be able to, understand proofs at a deep level, but they should understand these concepts that sort of give a notion of how the advantage of an attacker depends on things that might go wrong that change the expected advantage of an attacker.
So let's turn to your work in computer security. Your work on computing systems in the presence of adversaries is very interesting, I think. But I have a simple question. What is an adversary?
An adversary is someone who wants to do something bad.
So does that mostly boil down to policy and expressiveness of policy and deciding what's good and being able to express it somehow?
Policy is usually the hard part, and it's usually the part that academic research ignores, partly because it's the hard part, partly because it depends on all sorts of very application-specific things, figuring out what the right policy is. So I think one direction is sort of figuring out, can you learn the right policy or infer the right policy rather than try to actually explicitly figure it out.
I see. So using machine learning to kind of determine what it is?
Machine learning, it can be a fairly simple flavor of machine learning, but it's definitely sort of something where you're understanding from the dynamic behavior of a program what's normal and what's not normal, and then if something's not normal, maybe that's malicious and something you need to prevent. Maybe you can map it into something that's more of a normal behavior. Maybe you can disallow it because it's outside the expected behavior of the system.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of it sort of emerging from the soup a little bit, because I think in the past, a lot of really interesting work, including some of yours, was kind of hindered by trying to figure out how to express the policy and how to put that into code or put some boundaries in so that you were telling the machine or your mechanism what to look for.
Right. And there's a long history, and it sort of keeps being relived, of the people building systems assuming that programmers will write good policies and users will understand them. You were involved in this in the early days of mobile code on Java. Now the same exact thing is happening with Android.
Right.
It's a really not a good assumption to think that end users will be willing to read a complicated policy and decide whether or not they agree with it.
I think back in those days, Felton said it best when he said, given the choice between dancing pigs and security, users will pick dancing pigs every time.
Absolutely.
Might be cool, run it. Might be cool, run it.
Right. And you can't blame the users for that. That this is, I think, one of the places where our community has gone wrong is
right.
Blaming users for making bad security decisions as opposed to
assuming,
questioning why we should have systems where users can make a click in the wrong place and all of a sudden lose everything they've done.
Right. So can you quickly explain the notion of doing useful computation while preserving data privacy?
Yes. So this is work that we're working on. The main area is called secure computation, which is a bit of a misnomer. But the real idea is that you have two or more parties, but let's think of the case with two. And as usual, we'll have Alice and Bob, because we're talking about security. And they both have some private data. Example I like to use is the genetic data. So you've got your genome sequence, which pretty much everyone will have soon. It's getting down to, you know, a few thousand dollars to get a genome sequenced. So Alice and Bob meet in a bar and they want to find out if they're compatible as future life mates. And they can do this by analyzing their genomes and learning if they have any common diseases that they're carriers for, or other traits.
This you really make, are you know, an engineer.
Dating very efficient. This is the future. It may scare us, but you know, Facebook would scare people 10 years ago. So it will be a nice little, you know, Android app that people will bump their phones together and it will flash up, you know, you should consider mating or you should not. And maybe this won't happen in the next few years.
Okay, get to the privacy part.
Getting to the security issue. So they want to do this, but they don't want to give up their genome to the other party because maybe you know, Alice doesn't want Bob to learn about other things in her family history, or that she's likely to be an alcoholic, or you know, any other things that maybe you can learn from the genome. Hmm. So what you'd like to do is this computation that answers the question of, you know, are they carriers for any common diseases, without exposing the whole genome. And this is what secure computation allows you to do. It allows two parties to compute a function that depends on secret inputs from both parties without actually revealing those inputs. So you'll do a computation, you'll get the result. Both parties could see the result, but they don't learn anything else about the inputs. And this is the kind of thing that sounds like magic. It's a kind of thing you can do with cryptography that seems like it should be impossible, but there are actually ways, and they go back to the 80s. Andrew Yao developed one of the techniques that's called garbled circuits that allows you basically to compute any function you want without exposing the data by doing the computation on encrypted data.
Do you have to have the same amount of input coming from each party in that case, or was that just an artifact of your example?
You don't know. The inputs can be different. And a more realistic example, if you don't like the genetic dating, would be, say, someone's deciding whether a drug is the right drug for them, and they want to compare their genome to the genomes of all the participants in a study that the pharmaceutical company did. And there you've got, you know, a little bit of data coming from the individual. You've got a lot of data from the pharmaceutical company.
Right.
There's privacy requirements on both sides, but you get a useful result out that says you're liable to have this side effect or you're not, or this is the right drug for you or this other one would. So those are the kinds of things that if you can do large-scale computations this way, that you would not be able to do it without serious privacy concerns, without being able to do it as a secure computation. Mm-hmm. But if you could do it as secure computation, you could get very useful results that wouldn't reveal more than you want, which is the output of the computation.
Right. So why do you suppose privacy usually gets such short shrift in the U.S.?
It's the kind of thing you don't know that you've lost it until it's too late.
Right. Or maybe
I think that's, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's hard to know what the value of privacy is. And I think genetic data is something where I think most people do have sort of an intrinsic sense that this is very private and they might not want to, you know, they know it could be abused by insurance companies or abused by prospective employers. And there's a, you know, I think we are close to an inflection point where either people will decide there's so much benefit in generating and sharing all this data that we're going to decide it's not private anymore.
Mm-hmm. Like grocery store tabs.
Yeah. And the grocery store, you know, that's the, you know, do I really care enough about my, whether, you know, Safeway knows my eating habits to not be willing to save 5% on my grocery bill by giving them my my card number?
Right,
and
right.
I'm pretty okay with that. You know, that's one of the cases where it is a pretty clear trade-off. And it's also the case that, you know, even if you didn't do that, if you use the same credit card, they can track you anyway, or
right.
There are lots of other ways they could track you if they wanted to.
Yep.
So that's sort of a fairly open privacy trade-off that shows that most people don't value at least their grocery store purchases as now. That doesn't mean
I would want my grocery store purchases posted
on, you know, Google Plus or Facebook.
Exactly, but maybe the people don't even know that their data are being collected, right? Maybe they just say, "Oh, cool, 5% off," and they don't realize the downside.
Maybe. I think people probably are aware that they're being tracked. I don't know that they're as aware as of what's being done with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think people know, you know, when they get the coupons that are, gee, this is something you buy. This is not just random luck which coupons are being generated for
right.
you.
My favorite ones are when they say, here, try this product that you don't buy. It's a competitor to the product that you do. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. Let's talk about people's perceptions. Why do people think their gizmos are secure by default, even though they're not? Like, you know, what's up with smartphones? Why do people think that those are secure?
There's not a lot of other choices other than not to be part of the modern world.
So it doesn't really matter.
It's a real, you know, this is one of the biggest questions with secure computation is, you know, can you actually make it meaningful to end users in some way?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you did have an application like the toy one I described, would that you know, be perceived as any different to a typical end user from one that they download that has access to permission to read their genome, if that becomes an Android permission? But more, you know, straightforward current one would be the address book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something where I think it's figuring out the right way to present things to users. Because I think users do care, at least a lot of users do care. And there is sort of outrage every time sort of Facebook pushes the boundaries of what's private and what's not and changes something and people will first get up in arms and then everyone calms down and then, you know, Facebook makes a little tweak in the policy and then quietly changes it back to the one that is most exposing user data. And it's a hard thing to sort of understand what people value and whether you can design computing systems that really reflect that and make that transparent to mm-hmm. users. So far, I don't think anyone succeeded in doing that.
Right, right. Do you think that's just because of ignorance, or do you think that's because people really put a cheap price on their data, or maybe some combination?
It's a combination of that. I think the biggest thing I would say that is missing is understanding how the data is used, that, you know, people are willing to give their data to the grocery store because they think the grocery store is using it to target coupons to them and, you know, understand how to stock the shelves.
Right.
If the grocery store starts, you know, combining with their insurance company and using it to decide they're likely to have heart disease in a few years and they should raise their insurance rates.
Too much bacon.
People would not be happy with that. Right? So it's really sort of,
or they tell their rabbi that they're eating too much bacon.
Yeah, I mean, that would, I guess, be even worse. So it's a lot of it sort of how the data gets used and who really owns it and controls it. And I think that's where sort of the biggest issues with the mobile phone security have been. Sort of people are sort of okay with granting permissions that they understand to an app that is doing something useful for them. But when they learn that what's really happening is those are going to, you know, 100 different advertising networks that are combining them with all the data they're getting from their, you know, web traffic and building these profiles about them that they, you know, maybe if they're just using it to target advertising, that's still not too objectionable to most people. But there's, you know, potential for using it for other things.
Right, right, right. We live in interesting times.
We do.
So the last topic I wanted to discuss with you, Udacity is a really interesting experiment in massive open online courses. I guess they're called MOOCs.
I hate that name and acronym, but yes, people do call them that.
People call them MOOCs, and the New York Times has written about them that way. So you're working with Udacity now on leave from UVA.
Right.
Who owns what, and how do you pay for food?
So the who owns stuff question is easier. So everything that Udacity produces is released under a Creative Commons license. Mm-hmm. And all the faculty that come in and record courses for Udacity, they own the copyright on that and give Udacity an agreement to use that content as a limited commercial use and release the content under a Creative Commons non-commercial license. Mm-hmm. So that's the easy part of the answer. In terms of who pays for food, there is venture funding that is funding Udacity. The long-term revenue models for these kinds of ventures are still unclear. There are lots of possibilities. And
one that I saw that was kind of interesting was selling stuff to recruiters about students.
Yeah, so that's the one that we've done the most on is thinking about having students build a transcript with us. They've taken a set of courses. They've done something comparable to a top-level computer science degree, possibly with some extra focus on things the industry cares about. They also have a record of their social interactions, so we know that they've contributed to forum discussions and worked well with others, and the kinds of things that are very valuable for employers to target mm-hmm. the employees they want. And then employers would pay a recruiting fee to Udacity for the students who take classes and agree to participate in the recruiting program and are looking for jobs, that would be one way to gain revenues.
Right. So these days with stuff like the Research Without Walls Declaration, which I know that you've signed up for, and Udacity and this kind of, what would you say, escape from monetization happening, what happens to normal universities with buildings and stuff and electric bills?
So I don't think any of this is a real threat to well-run normal universities. And there was a lot of, I think, very misguided talk around UVA when President Sullivan was fired and then rehired about online education being part of that. I think that the on-ground experience is something that is never going to be replicated online.
Right,
that
right.
There is so much that students get out of being at a traditional university, spending 4 years in a place surrounded by working with other students, working closely with faculty, having that life experience that you get at an in-person university that is never going to be replicated online.
Well, that's too bad, because I had a business idea, which was, we just use Udacity for all the courseware, and then we set up these party centers, mm-hmm. and we just have people.
You run the keg parties.
Exactly.
So separately. Yeah.
Separately. And you can decide which keg party place where you want to live to take your online courses.
write up a proposal. I think even that, as important as keg parties might be to the university experience, I think is not going to replace the full on-ground experience. And it's great, for students who have the opportunity to do it, I think it's fantastic. I think there's no question that you want to keep that. I hope as a society we can continue to afford it, that it's become, that even a public university like UVA is getting out of reach for many students, and that's really unfortunate. And there's a big question as a society whether we want to support public education and whether how acceptable it is for students to end up graduating with mountains of debt and starting their life.
By the time that kind of Darina is old enough to go to college, it's going to be $1 million a semester.
Yeah, well, we're counting on her getting a basketball scholarship. So.
Is she already tall?
it's odd, because I'm short. My wife is short. Dorina's like 90 percentile for height when she was born.
Yeah, see, so those genome things, they don't really always work out.
Yeah, I think that probably won't last for her, but you never know.
All right, and the next to last question, tell us a cool story about attending the World Cup. You can pick South Africa or Germany or whatever.
World Cups are amazing things. The best one I attended was the Korea-Japan, partly because the U.S. did really well there. The cool thing about World Cups is it really does attract people from all over the world with a singular interest and sort of a shared universal kind of sense that you know, it's ultimately about a silly game, but it's something that brings people together and has a passion behind it.
So it makes you feel like a human being.
And the sense of being in Korea was, you know, the Koreans were such wonderful hosts that every country, they were fans of every country except for, even when the U.S. played Korea, there were Koreans that were sort of there to support the U.S. as a gesture of welcoming. And then everyone from other countries, you know, was welcomed as you're also a fan of Korea. And so they would, you know, teach you the Korean songs and be out all night on the streets where, you know, the Korean street food and drink is pretty amazing. And they would really make it so anyone who comes, wherever you're from, you know, you're really a Korean for that night as part of supporting the Korean national team and their
cool.
identity all tied up in it.
Cool. I assume you're going to Brazil.
Now that we have a baby, World Cup travel may be a little more challenging.
Uh-oh.
We'll see about that.
Uh-oh. All right, and the very last question. It's a toughie.
Okay.
GEB or Scheme?
Do you have to pick just one?
That's the question.
They both fit so well together. You can always do both.
Okay, that's a little mealy mouth, but I guess we'll let you get away with it. Thanks, Dave.
I mean, if I have to pick just one, I'll go with Python.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The May-June 2012 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on static analysis. The Silver Bullet interview features our conversation with UCSB professor and storied Capture the Flag veteran Giovanni Vigna. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.